Right, we've been looking at the subject for many weeks now of the fear of God. And we have gone through quite carefully in seeking to find out what it is. We began by just looking to see how often the subject of the fear of God appeared in the scriptures. We found that it's a dominant biblical theme. It's found from the beginning of the scriptures to the end. And it's found even in heaven amongst those who believe. We found that the fear of God is something that can be defined in two ways. That it can be defined in terms of dread and terror, such as you might feel if you're a little boy and you turn the corner and you see the local bully coming straight towards you. You'd be terrified. That is certainly how non-Christians should fear God. But we saw also there is fear of God in the sense of reverence and awe. The sense of reverence and awe that you would feel if you were sitting round the side of the ballroom at Buckingham Palace and suddenly the Queen or the Duke of Edinburgh came up and started to talk to you and you go, "Ah!" Not that you're terrified that they are going to hack you to pieces, but you hold them in such awe because of the position that they hold in our society. And that is the sort of fear that we should know of God if we are believers in the Lord Jesus Christ. We've seen that in order to have such a fear of God, we need first of all to have a correct concept of God's character. Who is God? What is God like? And if we all think that God is an old man sitting on a cloud with a long white beard, wringing his hands when he sees people doing wrong and saying, "Oh, if only they wouldn't do that," then we've got a wrong view of God. And one of the problems is that that's the sort of view of God people have. And so they have no fear of God. Secondly, we need to have a pervasive sense of the presence of God. That God is omnipotent, all powerful. God is omniscient, all knowing. And God is omnipresent. He is everywhere. And so wherever we happen to be, we cannot escape from the presence of God. He sees us. Knows what we're doing. He even knows what we're thinking in our minds. And then thirdly, we saw that one of the essential ingredients was having a sense of the obligation that we have before God, what God requires of us, such that we know what we should do, even when we don't always achieve it. And then we saw last time that the source of the fear of God was, I'm going to sneeze in a moment, so you'll excuse me. It's past, which means that coming in 2 minutes I will. The source of the fear of God is a blessing that results from God's gracious purposes in our hearts. That it's a blessing that God gives to those who are the beneficiaries of the new covenant that the Lord Jesus Christ has brought. God said in his promises in Jeremiah that he would put his law within our hearts that we might fear him. Well, we now come on tonight to consider the effect that the fear of God should have upon our conduct. In what way should we live in the light of the fear of God? Well, I've got a whole string of references here. I'm not sure we'll look at them all. I did have some others that we could use. But we won't go to all of them. But certainly we'll begin in the passage that we read, and that is Genesis 20. Abraham went to live in the land of Gerar, and the ruler of that land, Abimelech, believing that Abraham's wife Sarah was in fact his sister, took her as his own wife, because Abraham was afraid that if he said, "This is my wife," so great was her beauty, he was afraid that the people of the land would put him to death. And that's exactly what Abraham says in verse 11. Abimelech says in verse 10, "Why have you done this thing? What did you have in view that you have done this thing?" Abraham said, "Because I thought, surely the fear of God is not in this place, and they will kill me on account of my wife." Abraham reasoned thus. There's no fear of God here, and because there's no fear of God, there is no moral restraint on these people. And these people, therefore, will not fear killing me in order to steal my wife away. But what we find is that because God speaks directly to Abimelech, that when Abimelech relates this in verse 8 to his servants, they were very afraid. And so it's a restraint upon their conduct, and it prevents them from doing what Abraham feared that they would do. Whether in fact that's what they would have done or not, we're not ever told. The Bible doesn't tell us, give us speculations, but we're told that was Abraham's fear, and when God spoke to this man, there was fear in his heart. In Genesis 42, this is a situation where Joseph's brothers go to meet with him, not knowing who he is, and they're living in great awe of this man. They are terrified of this man. They don't know who he is. They don't know that, in fact, he's their brother. They know that this man is second only to Pharaoh, and they are coming to him in order to try and acquire some food. And they're in fear of their lives. And in verse 18, Joseph said to them, the third day, do this and live, for I fear God. He's comforting them. Do this and live, for I fear God. You're living in dread of me, that I will do you harm. But you don't need to fear me, because I fear God. And I will treat you justly and righteously because of my fear of God. So the fear of God has a direct bearing upon the behaviour of Joseph in this context. So turn over to one of my favourite Old Testament chapters, which is Leviticus 19. And doubtless remember that we have in this chapter the prohibition upon the wearing of Marks and Spencer's shirts, because they are made of polyester and cotton, and therefore they are prohibited. Verse 19, you shall keep my statutes, you shall not let your livestock breed with another kind, you shall not sow your field with mixed seed, nor shall a garment of mixed fibre come upon you. That's not the verse we're in fact looking at. But it does show us that the whole of the Old Testament law has gone and finished with, and that's why we can quite happily wear polyester and cotton shirts. But in verse 14, you read this. You shall not curse the deaf, nor put a stumbling block before the blind, but you shall fear your God. I am the Lord. Now, what's wrong with cursing the deaf? They can't hear you. What's wrong with putting a stumbling block in the way of the blind? They can't see you. They don't know you. I ask, but God does. God sees all these things, and God hears all these things, and God remembers all these things. So just because the person doesn't know what you're doing, what you're saying, doesn't mean that you can get away with it. Because God sees. God sees it all. He knows. It reminds me of a film, Fred Astaire film, I forget the name of it now, but they end up in Venice, and one of the other actors, not Fred Astaire, at one point he's speaking to a Venetian policeman, and he discovers that the policeman does not understand a word of English. And he says to himself, I've always wanted to do this, and with a beaming smile on his face, he says to the policeman, you are a buffoon. You are a flat-footed idiot. Ho, ho, ho. And out comes this stream of abuse. And the policeman is saying, gracias, gracias, or whatever language it was in. And then when he's finished, the policeman pulls out his phrase book and says, I arrest you for... So all very highly entertaining. It's an indication of the levity of the whole film. But it's the same with God. We may curse people, and we may say, oh, but they're deaf, so they don't know what I'm saying. But God knows. And so we should not do these things because we should be in fear of God. Do not curse the deaf. Don't put a stumbling block in the way of the blind. Fear God. Yeah. I'll just mention some areas where this is relevant for us. Those of us that have had to do exams, how often it's been tempting to cheat and to go in with things written on the back of your hand, things written up your sleeve, all manner of ways, in order that you can be sure that you pass the exam. And we think we're so clever when we get 100% as a result of doing that. But God has seen, God knows that we've cheated. We shouldn't do it. When we fill in our income tax forms, there's always the temptation, well, I won't quite put down everything because the tax man takes too much as it is. I won't tell him about everything. Well, God knows, and God sees. And if we fear God, then we will be quite careful in what we put down on our tax form. Because God sees, God knows, and God remembers. Nobody else may see, but God sees. If we fear God, we'll do it right. Doesn't mean we don't try and avoid tax. Tax avoidance is quite legitimate, because that is seeking to minimise legally the amount of tax we pay. And God would approve of that if we make good use of the money we save. But to evade tax, that is wrong. And even if nobody else ever discovers it, God knows. God sees. So now it's Proverbs. Proverbs chapter 8. And verse 13. The fear of the Lord is to hate evil. Pride and arrogance and the evil way and the perverse mouth I hate. So if you have a fear of God, it will keep you away from evil and give you a hatred of evil. The fear of the Lord is to hate evil. And if you hate it, you'll avoid it. You'll want nothing to do with it. And so the fear of God is intimately bound up with our behaviour, the way in which we live. Chapter 16 of Proverbs. And verse 6. In mercy and truth, atonement is provided for iniquity. And by the fear of the Lord, one departs from evil. Now you can have the corollary of that. That a person devoid of the fear of God goes towards evil. That's what we shall discover as we move on. Nehemiah, chapter 5, verse 14. Nehemiah speaking about his governorship. Moreover, from the time that I was appointed to be their governor in the land of Judah, from the 20th year until the 32nd year of King Artaxerxes, 12 years, neither I nor my brothers ate the governor's provisions. But the former governors who had been before me laid burdens on the people and took from them bread and wine, besides 40 shekels of silver. Yes, even their servants bore rule over the people. But I did not do so because of the fear of God. Nehemiah didn't say, right everybody, I'm the boss, therefore you provide all my needs and I'm going to line my pockets. Now that is exactly what the politicians of this country used to do. You read the history of the 18th century. And it was the accepted thing that if you got into high office, then you became extremely wealthy because you were usually corrupt and you lined your own pockets and the books were never audited. So all this money came pouring into the treasury and some of it was siphoned off into your bank account. Nehemiah said that he would not do that because of the fear of God. It was a
a restraint upon any evil within his heart. Any temptations to do evil, he was restrained from doing so. Then let's look at Matthew chapter 6, and we find that the reverse is also the case. Take heed that you do not do your charitable deeds before men, to be seen by them. Otherwise you have no reward from your Father in heaven. Therefore, when you do a charitable deed, do not sound a trumpet before you, as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, that they may have glory from men. Assuredly, I say to you, they have their reward. When you do a charitable deed, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing. Your charitable deed may be seen, may be in secret, and your Father who sees in secret will himself reward you openly. And Jesus talks also about prayer being in secret, and fasting being in secret, so that other people don't see. And the reasons for doing these things is not that other men will see and say, "Well done, well done, what a wonderful godly person that is." That's exactly what the Pharisees wanted. They wanted to display their righteousness and gain the applause of men. And that's exactly what they received. They got the applause of men. And Jesus says, they have their reward. They sought the applause of men, they got the applause of men. And they get nothing from God. And the reason they behave like this is because there's no fear of God within them. They have no concept of God's requirements and who God is. And so therefore, because they have no fear of God, they're just concerned about other people and making sure that everybody thinks that they're wonderful. Turn to Matthew 23 and verse 25. And if you ever hear people saying, "Oh, gentle Jesus, meek and mild, wouldn't say boo to a goose, and certainly wouldn't denounce people like you often do from the pulpit," well, they should really read Matthew 23. You can't get more enunciatory than this. Verse 23. "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! For you pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin, and have neglected the weightier matters of the law, justice and mercy and faith. These you ought to have done without leaving the others undone. Blind guides who strain out a gnat and swallow a camel. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you cleanse the outside of the cup and dish, but inside they are full of extortion and indulgence. Blind Pharisee, first cleanse the inside of the cup and dish, that the outside of them may be clean also. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you are like whitewashed tombs, which indeed appear beautiful outwardly, but inside are full of dead men's bones and all uncleanness. Even so, you also outwardly appear righteous to men, but inside you are full of hypocrisy and lawlessness." Well, they give the appearance of righteousness, but they're in fact ungodly, unrighteous people. And it's because within their breasts there is no sense of the fear of God, and therefore they behave in the way that they do, in an ungodly manner. And in Colossians 3:22. Two more to go after this. Colossians 3:22. Paul is giving practical advice to the believers in Corinth, and he's speaking to slaves regarding how they should behave towards their masters. "Servants, obey in all things your masters according to the flesh, not with eye service as men pleasers, but in the sincerity of heart, fearing God." Now, when you're seeking to obey your masters, you don't say, "Well, what do they think?" Not seeking to please them. What you're seeking to do is to please God. So therefore you will fear God. "Have I obeyed my master as God wants me to obey my master?" And that is the concern of the believer. And it of course applies in the realm of work. I am not here to serve my boss at work. I am here to serve God. And so I obey my master as if I was obeying God, because that's what I am doing. And that is done in the fear of God. And that should ensure that in your work you are one of the best workers at your place of employment. not necessarily the case, because you might not have the same skills and abilities as others. But that's your motivation. And it's different from the non-Christian's motivation. Two more references. Matthew chapter 10. Jesus is speaking in the context of evangelism. And he's sending them out to preach the gospel. And he says, you are going to face opposition. And there is going to be a great temptation that you shut up. You're preaching the gospel and someone says, if you carry on like that, I'll chop your head off. You might think, well, perhaps I'd better stop. Jesus says, no, no, persevere. Matthew 10:27, whatever I tell you in the dark, speak in the light. And what you hear in the ear, preach from the housetops. And do not fear those who kill the body, but cannot kill the soul. But rather fear him, God, who is able to destroy both soul and body in hell. That's who you ought to fear. So when someone comes along and makes all manner of threats, don't fear them. Because God is able to do far worse things to you than they are. God who you ought to fear. And if you have the fear of God in your heart, then you will persevere in evangelism. And you will even become a martyr if necessary, rather than renounce Christ. And we have many examples of this. There's a very clear one with Bishop John Hooper, Bishop of Gloucester, at the time of Bloody Mary. And he went to the stake rather than recant. And he was told by a friend, consider, Master Hooper, that life is sweet and death is bitter. Just recant for the moment, and then you'll continue to be helpful for us. I don't want to see you die. And Hooper sat there musing in his cell, and he said, yes. Yes, indeed, you're right. Life is sweet. And death is bitter. But eternal life is more sweet. And eternal death is more bitter. I'll go to the stake rather than renounce Christ. So the fear of God is a spur to perseverance in evangelism. And then lastly, out of the enormous list of references that we could look at, one that we looked at last week in the morning, Romans chapter 3, which is in fact a quote from the Old Testament, from Psalm 36. What is the thing that sums up the ungodliness of the human race? Why is it that men are so corrupt and so wicked? The reason is, there is no fear of God before their eyes. There is no fear of God before their eyes. And because there's no fear of God, they do all manner of evil, wicked, ungodly, and immoral things. We've seen just in that brief survey of the scriptures that the fear of God has a very direct application to the way in which we behave. If we know that God is here with us, and we have a right fear of God, then we will seek in all things to do that which is right and pleasing in his sight. And that sometimes the reason why Christians fall into sin is because they lose that sense of the fear of God, which allows them to take that one step too far into sin. Just consider David's sin with Bathsheba. If he had had a proper sense of the fear of God in his heart, would he have sinned in that way? I think the answer is no, he would not. I want to now briefly consider with you some of the consequences of all this. And especially in the situation in which we find ourselves in Britain in this part of the 20th century. Suppose you were given the task of demolishing a house. Where would you begin? Now, this isn't just, okay, well, this house needs to come down. This is a house that someone's living in, and they're an enemy, and you want the house destroyed. What do you do? You get a ladder, climb up on the roof with a pickaxe, and start smashing away the tiles, smashing away the chimney stack? Well, it wouldn't be very long
before they came outside and they climbed up the ladder and said, "Oi, what are you doing? Get down!" Now, what you do is you go down into the basement and you start knocking away all the foundations of the house. Now, if you were able up on the roof to continue your work uninterrupted, after a few days you might have done quite a bit of damage to the roof. And people could see what you'd done. But if you're down in the cellar, nobody would see what you'd done. Nobody would be aware that any day now, the whole structure would collapse. The devil has been working for many, many years to undermine the gospel, to undermine the scriptures. And he's been doing it in this subtle, quiet way, undermining godliness by attacking the foundations, not by attacking the superstructure. And so we have liberalism, which has undermined belief in the scriptures. Totally unjustified. The scriptures, even if you examine them as critically as you care to, still come out as being the most reliable book that we have. That all its history, time and time again, is shown to be true. But that's not what's taught in universities. What's taught in universities is, well, it's probably a pack of lies. You can't trust it at all. And you get university professors saying that. And they've got no grounds for saying it at all. That's what's taught. And so that's what comes out in pulpits. And that's what's believed by people that attend church. And eventually they get to the point where they say, well, what's the point? If this book's a waste of time, let's throw it away. If this book's a waste of time, well, what are we coming here in the first place for? Why bother? And so churches are emptying and emptying and emptying. And you look at the statistics. And all the major denominations that have been ravaged by liberalism are in terminal decline. And whatever happens with the Church of England as a result of their vote on women priests, the Church of England is going to fall apart anyway, because numbers are declining so rapidly. And I think that this last week's vote is just going to hasten that. And we're going to see it happening in 5 years instead of 10. So the devil's used liberalism to undermine the whole of this and to take away the fear of God. And so God's character has been undermined. And so you talk to people about God. Who is God? Well, God is man sitting on a cloud. I mean, I use this illustration a lot, don't I? But that is the view people have of God. You go into a classroom and you say to the children, "I want you to draw a picture of God." Well, you shouldn't do that anyway, but you do get people doing that. And so often there is this old white man, wearing white with a long white beard, probably with a halo, sitting on a cloud. And that's the conception people have of God. And what's God like? Oh, God's a God of love. Yes, and? Well, just a God of love, that's it. And nothing else. No concept of God as a holy God, as a just God, as a righteous God, as a God who must punish sin. And while it's very nice to consider that, yes, God's a God of love, to leave it there doesn't just give you an abbreviated view of God, it gives you a false view of God. Because people have this wrong view of love, that if you love someone, then you never will tell them off. You'll never discipline them. You'll never punish them. And yet that is not love in the scriptures. So the devil, through liberalism, has totally undermined any concept of the character of God. And you undermine the character of God? Well, how can you fear God if God's this old man sitting on a cloud that loves everybody? So God's character's been attacked. We've had humanism, which basically says that we're wonderful. And the problem with the human race is not sin, there's no such thing. The problem with the human race is lack of education. And we need to be taught to be nice to one another. But then even that's undermined. Because then you have evolution that says that man is an animal. Well, I've never yet seen a criminal case brought by a wildebeest against a lion. You see it on the nature programs on the box. You see wildebeest being attacked by lions and being killed and eaten. Well, why isn't that lion put in the dock? Doesn't happen. But if we're animals, why can't I go out and kill someone? What's wrong with that? Who can tell me that I'm wrong? No one. And all these people come out and say, oh, a dreadful thing to do. Give me a reason. They can't. It's totally irrational apart from God and God's law and what God has said. If we're all animals, then why don't we treat ourselves as animals? And it's an indication that there is no such person as an atheist. We all know there is a God, and God has standards. And it's within us all. And we try and push it aside and forget it. But you keep telling people that they're animals, they'll behave like animals. And I'm not just thinking of England football supporters, all of them. It affects everybody. So we've got to rebuild the foundations. And it's difficult, because this false teaching that the devil has put forward has infected everything. And so if you start talking about the wrath of God, a God who is angry, a God who should be feared, people turn around and say, you slipped a century. You're a Puritan. Why don't you walk around wearing one of those stovepipe hats? Etc. No concept of who God is. We've got to rebuild those foundations. And we need to make sure, first of all, we've got those foundations to build on. If we haven't got them, there's no way we're going to teach them to anybody else. Some people would respond to this and say, oh, this is unbalanced. And I would say, not at all. The reason is, and I would quote here Martin Luther, if in confessing Christ I hold back at the one point that is at that moment being attacked. This is not an accurate quote, by the way. I am not, insofar as I hold back at that point, I am not confessing Christ. So if someone comes along and starts attacking the truth of the scriptures, and we hold back and say, oh, but I don't want to appear to be a fundamentalist. At that point, you're not confessing Christ. Someone comes along and says, I can't believe in an angry God. Sit back and we don't say anything, at that point we're not confessing Christ. And so where the world attacks the truth, that's where we have to take our strongest stand. And if we don't do that, we're not confessing Christ. And so we'll be unbalanced, if you want to say we're unbalanced, because there is a need for being unbalanced at those specific points. And so if you think that sometimes I overemphasize the wrath of God, it's because in our culture and society, it is not necessary to tell people that God is the God of love. They believe that anyway. It's the wrath of God that they don't believe. That's where we need to put the emphasis. If there should come a day, I think it's highly unlikely, where people are living in abject dread and terror of God, and do believe in the wrath of God, then we need to start saying, look, God's a God of love. And then we'll be unbalanced in that way. But it will be because we need to restore the balance. So it's not being unbalanced to stress the things that are being most denied. If we want to re-establish the fear of God in our society. Because without the fear of God, we will never get a moral change within our society. Let me give you a quote from the Puritan. The fear of God is the holy soil which produces a godly life. The absence of the fear of God is the unholy soil that produces an ungodly life. And so it is foolish to attempt to establish any form of ethics or morals without true religion, without the fear of God. There's no fear of God, not no ethics. And that's what you see in society around us. There's no fear of God, anything goes. And so therefore, what we need, if we want to see society changed, is not political action. Because that's not the problem. It's not we need to build more schools, though I'm not against that. It's not we need to build more hospitals, though I'm not against that. It's not that we need to see the nation get back to work, though I'm not against that. What we need is the preaching of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And then when people hear it and people believe it, people will fear God, and then their morals will change. That's the way to do it. And we can stand up and pontificate and preach as much as we want about it. Oh, it's important that you do the right things. But people won't do the right things unless they fear God. That's where our emphasis needs to be. Gospel preaching. And if you look at the history of our country, the history of the world, ethical and social changes for the good have only come about through revival. Through the preaching of the gospel, through successful evangelism when people are converted. We need to ask ourselves also, to what degree are our children learning to fear God? How much are they imbibing from their friends around them, from the television, from all the other things that are thrown at them? Are they learning to fear God? Do they learn to fear God at home, in their homes? Do they see their parents are godly people who fear God? What are we communicating to? Are they learning the fear of God? What is the church communicating to the outside world? Do we show by our lives and by our manner that we fear God and God is someone to be feared? And in that connection we could ask ourselves, well, why are we here? Are we here because of tradition? Because it's the done thing? Or because it's God that we seek? And we're seeking to serve Him and to obey Him. And now, since the fear of God is such a powerful stimulus to godly living, we should therefore seek to increase it and not to lessen it. Indeed, we should avoid anything which will lessen our sense of the fear of God. And that's what we're going to look at next time. How do we maintain and increase our sense of the fear of God? And so we'll leave it there for now and ask if anybody has any comments or any questions.